And on this first prom choral Sunday, we go live to the Royal College of Music in London, where we join Sarah Walker.
Good evening from the Royal College of Music. Tonight at the proms, we've a rare opportunity to hear Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony. It's going to be played live for us at the Royal Albert Hall by a whole host of ensembles centering around the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Now, having worked with them before, I know that this orchestra is always up for a challenge. And with the Gothic Symphony, they've opted to perform the world's longest symphony. It has mythical status among scholars, musicians, and listeners. And this chance to really experience it and not just know it by reputation is really not to be missed. The tickets have been flying out of the box office. So with the help of my three contributors here this evening and some CD extracts, I want to lift the veil on the Gothic Symphony. With me are Nick Whiting, Associate Leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Ian Fisher, the orchestra's third horn, and Adrian Partington, Chorus Master. We'll be chatting a bit later about your individual input into the performance, but I want to just give a clear impression right now about what sort of a beast we're dealing with. Adrian is in charge of the massive choral forces. Four mixed choirs, children's choir, and a quartet of soloists. And Nick and Ian are part of an enormous orchestra, each section about three times as big as usual, with lots of unusual additions such as contrabass clarinet, contrabassoons, contrabass trombone. There's an oboe d'amore, there's a bass oboe, there's organ. There's lots of percussion, including a thunder machine, and four offstage brass bands. So here is a little sample of what's in store for us. So there we have a climactic passage from part two of the work, voices and orchestra making an incredible noise, and you can imagine what that's going to sound like over in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, let's rewind to the start now and get to know the movements one by one. And to put things in context, we're dealing with a work of two main parts, and each one has three movements. The first part is for orchestra only, and the second part, that's where all the voices, all the extra instruments come in. And that is the really heavyweight part of the symphony. It's much longer than the first. In fact, when the symphony starts, you might think we're in for something fairly conventional. The first movement is based on two contrasting themes, just like a classical symphony. Here's the start of the first movement, and you'll hear the first main theme very soon after the opening. So there we have the opening bars of the Gothic Symphony. What sort of mood is Havergal Brian setting there? Well, I certainly get an impression of great determination there in a rather dark context, courage in adversity. And I think those qualities tie in with some of the information that Brian gives us about the work. The quote from Goethe's Faust, which he includes at the head of the score, "He who strives with all his might, that man we can redeem." In fact, he intended the whole of the first half to reflect the story of Faust, the man who is so curious for knowledge and personal growth that he begins dabbling with forces stronger than he can control. And there are parallels here with the title of the symphony, the Gothic, because Brian thought of the Gothic age as an age of incredible progress, cultural advancement for mankind. And Faust's personal journey has echoes of the cultural journey of medieval man. So the first movement, in fact, the music as a whole, has a probing feeling. It's always moving forwards. Let's hear the second theme from the first movement now. It's highly contrasted to the first one, which is what we'd expect from a traditional symphony. And Nick is going to play this more gentle theme for us now. Thank you. Thank you, Nick. Well, that was the second main theme of the Gothic Symphony's first movement. It's much more suave than the first theme. Let's hear how Brian develops this lyrical theme. It's interesting because it starts sounding rather pastoral. And if that reminded you a little of Vaughan Williams, well, see what you make of this violin solo, which comes later, just before the lyrical theme returns to lead the first movement towards its end. There's a little passage marked recit, which leads back to the lyrical theme, and Nick's going to play this for us. Thank you, Nick. And that leads on to the return of the folk-like theme, beautifully coloured and harmonised. Also, listen to the detail in the woodwind writing, such a lot of detail despite the number of instruments playing. And lovely writing for the timps in there too. But we hear a lovely falling phrase going all through the woodwind section. Piccolo, flutes, oboe d'amore, bass oboe, cor anglais, bassoon, clarinets, bass clarinets, and harps and celeste making it all twinkle. So that is the tranquil middle section of the first movement, though the music doesn't stay peaceful. The darkness and anxiety of the opening returns. And listen out for some more fantastic writing for the timps. And of course the organ, which is going to sound. So we'll hear to the end of the movement. The end of the first movement of the Gothic Symphony, and without giving us the slightest break, Havergal Brian moves straight onto the second movement. Now, this has been described as a march, but it's a march with five beats in a bar. It opens with timps and tubas, and their dotted rhythms turn out to be a very important element of this movement. And just a few bars later, the lower strings play a haunting march melody. It's slightly oriental sounding, and that's also an important ingredient later on. So let's hear those seminal opening bars. Thank you. quite a strange harmonic feel to the music there. The notes of that string melody sound as though they could be from an exotic scale. So I don't know about you, but already for me, the myth of Havergal Brian being a rather isolated, parochial English composer divorced from musical progress around him, that seems untrue. The Funeral March character of the music here seems to imply that he was very much aware of world events, and after all, he did start writing the piece in 1919. Well, this movement builds in intensity, and for me, the impression of armed conflict becomes stronger. And this extract shows how the material is developed, and there's a sort of ticking time bomb feel here, which reminds me a little of the ballroom scene in Prokofiev's Cinderella when the clock strikes midnight. It's really nightmarish, and it seems to say, "Leave now, your time is up." An uncannily clock-like section in the middle of the second movement of the Gothic Symphony. But Havergal Brian won't let us lose sight of that march theme for too long, or the opening rhythm. There's a climactic point where all six horns have the theme, and although we don't have six horns here right now, we do have Ian Fisher on the third horn. And Ian is going to demonstrate this theme, which is marked at this point like a ceremonial triumphant march. Thank you, Ian. And soon after that, the second movement comes to its end. This big build-up dies out, and the music has an exhausted feel. So let's hear that close now. Great use of bass clarinet there. And this moves seamlessly into the third movement, which is marked vivace, and this gets the energy all stirred up again. Start of the Gothic Symphony's third movement, and Havergal Brian has started to throw a few more interesting things at us. The twittering effects in the woodwind there, quite atonal, not at all harmonizing with the repeated pattern that's going on in the lower instruments. He's starting to push us further into a less and less orthodox world. And maybe he wants us to be reminded of Faust seeking after hidden knowledge and wishing to explore the mystical. In the second part of Goethe's Faust, the character wakes in a field of fairies. And later on, we also encounter angels, messengers of divine mercy. Maybe those twittering effects could be suggesting these winged creatures. Well, if I could turn to Ian now, he's going to play for us the waltz-like horn melody that was embedded in that complex texture, which is stated quite powerfully a little later on as the material is developed in quite a passionate way. Thanks, Ian. Well, I think the waltz character of that theme is quite interesting. Waltzes have a decadent feel. If you think of Ravel's La Valse, written at exactly the same time Havergal Brian started work on the Gothic Symphony in 1919, that's often seen as a depiction of decay, of social breakdown, a throwback to a privileged lifestyle that was no longer viable. And of course, waltzes have Faustian connotations too, thanks to the Mephisto waltzes by Liszt. Well then, to add to all this sort of nightmare ballroom imagery, we have a return to the clock-like textures that we heard in the second movement. So once again, the use of a ticking clock effect to create tension. And as you probably sense there, the harmony is becoming denser and more complex. We seem to arrive at an area of calm with some manic little highlights from the Glockenspiel. It's as if the earlier waltz material could have gone either way, either towards magic or towards horror. And for a while, it seems magical, but things do become more disturbing. And that effect is repeated and repeated, building up to a terrific climax that brings us almost to the end of the movement. The waltz theme doesn't come back, but there is a feeling of revisiting the energy of the earlier part of the piece. And if anything, we're plunged into an even darker world. So that brings us to the end of part one of the Gothic Symphony. We've been listening to the music for about 40 minutes at this stage, but we don't get a break. The music carries straight on to part two, which is longer and bigger, more instruments and voices. So Adrian Partington, who's been sitting very patiently with us, is going to be able to give us a few insights into the choral aspects of the symphony. In the meantime, I'm interested to learn a little bit more about the experience of playing this music from my two instrumentalist guests from the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Associate Leader Nick Whiting and Third Horn Ian Fisher. Nick, how challenging has it been to rehearse this piece?
Well, as a piece of music, it's extremely awkward to play. Havergal Brian, I think he stretches the boundaries of practically every instrument in the orchestra. And certainly for the violin writing, maybe a composer would write something, and the composer might write 8 VA, which means you play it up an octave. But no, not with Havergal Brian. He writes 16 VA, you play it up two octaves. And he does make the violin part go extremely high indeed. But as far as rehearsals go, I mean, we've been very fortunate in having Martin Brabins as our conductor, and he's conducted the rehearsals quite literally with extreme efficiency and charm and wit, and mustering the forces of what must be nearly 1,000, it seemed quite effortless to us, and possibly not to him though. But it's been quite a pleasurable experience, I have to say.
And Ian, if I could turn to you, how did you feel at the first rehearsal? Do you remember it being daunting as you went into that first session?
Well, we didn't know exactly what we were in for, but as Nick said, it's it's something I think that's grown on us. I think the second hearing is better, so you may have to wait another 30 years to hear again. But it's a piece. I mean, it's so big. I mean, you mentioned the size of the forces. I mean, what you didn't mention, I noticed today stumbling through the percussion, that at one point they've got an old washing machine drum full of rocks, which they shake. I'm not sure if the Authentic Performance Brigade would agree with that, because I'm sure it's not an early 20th century washing machine tub. It looks far too recent for that. But, you know, the massive forces, you are going to get moments of enormous energy. As we have, you know, well, it's the National Orchestra of Wales and the BBC Concert Orchestra and all the extras and the choirs stacked up way above behind us and to the side, as you mentioned, the four off-stage, on-stage brass bands. There are times of immense emotion. And I think the skill also is to use those forces in more subtle ways as well, which Brian does. I mean, I think sometimes, if I have to be critical, and who am I to be critical, maybe sometimes he tries to be too clever. He tries to put too many layers on, and it's not always easy to pick them out. But, you know, the effect is there. So I'm sure everyone will enjoy this evening.
And how well do you feel he actually writes for the horn?
Not very well at all.
Because I noticed in the Scott, I mean, there are
you
quite a lot
the way
of...
I played those.
In your notes. There are quite a lot of horn highlights, aren't there? He obviously likes your instrument.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you take someone like Richard Strauss, who was, you know, pushing the boundaries of his day, but he always wrote, a lot of the horn parts sound immensely difficult, and they are. They're written with an eye to the history of the instrument, to the way the harmonic series works, the way the instrument used to be played. And obviously, as you move further away from the history, people move and become more chromatic, which, you know, there's no great problem with that. But the way Brian writes, sometimes it doesn't sit easily under the fingers or on the face.
Thank you. Well, Adrian, if I could bring you in now, tell me about your experience of choir mastering the piece. Have you ever conducted anything quite so big before?
No, I've not, and I've not chorus mastered anything quite as big as this. I suppose the nearest thing is Mahler's Eighth Symphony, and I think a lot of the writing, vocal writing, probably instrumental as well, is rather akin to what Mahler was doing. This supercharged polyphony, you know. Once the choirs concerned are divided into 37 parts. And the typical form of writing in this piece is contrapuntal. And sometimes it seems to me like Speminalium, you know, big talis piece in 40 parts. But Havergal-Brian doesn't have quite such a clear harmonic scheme as talis. And that is what really causes the difficulties. Because when you're writing counterpoint, you know, you're trying to match lots of different tunes at the same time, and they're supposed to sort of coincide. But Havergal-Brian often doesn't, and that's really what the problem is. It's I'm sure it's completely well calculated, but often it's very, very dissonant. And that is really the problem. The lines are very angular, lots of diminished and augmented intervals, huge range for the voices. And the sheer stamina required is quite a lot.
But I know you have quite an interesting theory about some of those more ugly, difficult, dissonant bits, something to do with Gothic architecture.
Well, I have read this, and I'm sure people in the audience have read it as well, that his vision was of trying to create one of these great Gothic cathedrals in sound. Mm. And that explains to me the huge proportions of it. In the BBC Proms book, there's a picture of Rouen Cathedral in half term. When I was having a break from rehearsals, I actually went to Rouen to have a look at the cathedral and see if I could apply my theory. But the deliberate ugliness and occasional humour are just, like, for me, like the musical equivalents of what the medieval masons were doing. Sometimes they would put little heads with tongues sticking out and little friezes with all sorts of funny things. I mean, in where I work at Gloucester Cathedral, there's a famous frieze with rabbits leading processions. And that's what I think these deliberately eccentric things are.
Sort of musical gargoyles.
Yeah, musical gargoyles, exactly. Absolutely.
Have there been big issues with stamina for the singers? It must be a huge sing.
It is a huge sing, because they're singing most of the time through that finale, which is an hour long. Yes, there have been, I suppose, although all the singers involved are used to singing things like Marlowe and The Kingdom and that sort of thing, which require a lot, because it's actually, in total, not longer than your average oratorio. But it's the extremities of the voices which he's using all the time. I mean, the sopranos are screaming B flats and Bs all the time, and he expects basses to go down to bottom D. And no, I don't know any other composer apart from Rachmaninoff who actually asks basses to sing bottom Ds all the time. Well, not many can, it has to be said.
Well, now we're going to hear some choice excerpts. You've picked out some of the most interesting choral moments for us to explore. So let's press on now into the second half of the Gothic Symphony, and this is how the second half starts. So part two begins with the setting of the Te Deum, the Christian hymn meaning "We praise thee, O God." This had a personal significance for Havergal O'Brien. He had a strong childhood memory of going to Lichfield Cathedral as a chorister to take part in a performance of a Te Deum as part of Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee celebrations. And he retained an impression of something on a vast scale, he later recalled. And the huge scale of much Gothic architecture was always something that he admired. So the symphony's title is now starting to really fit the music. We felt the probing, exploring philosophy of medieval man in the first part, and now we're returning to the ancient language that he might have used. Well, throughout this part of the symphony, Brian's language becomes more eclectic, more harmonically challenging. The instrumental writing becomes more extreme too. I'm going to ask Nick to play a first violin part from a bit later on, near the start of a faster section. Fantastic. Thank you, Nick. Now, when you listen to the music as a whole, you will barely hear the part that Nick just played. The forces are so huge. As we get further into this movement, the choir proclaiming the words joyfully, there's a feeling of brightness. The music may be more clashing, a bit more abrasive than in the first half, but it's also a lot more uplifting. Here's a sample from the CD. You may need your sunglasses here.
Thank you.
Now, after that, you may have lost sight of the strongly defined themes and motifs that we heard in the first part of the symphony. The Bryan expert, Malcolm MacDonald, has said that what really ties the second part together is the text, the Te Deum itself. Well, here's an excerpt that Adrian Partington wanted to highlight. Adrian, what do you think of his writing for voices that we're going to hear?
Well, in the passage that we're about to hear, it's actually quite straightforward. But what is fantastic is the contrapuntal complexity of it. It's one of those passages where the art is concealed by the effect, because it is beautifully written. And, you know, the 1624 parts all singing quite singable phrases. So this is not one of those where the voices are being stressed.
Words tu rex gloriae, thou art king of glory, part of the wonderful positivity of the Gothic Symphony's fourth movement, which also finds us in a different key. We've moved up a step to E major, which helps to explain this new brightness. We're moving on now to the fifth movement, and this one sets just one line of text. Iudex crederis esse venturus. We believe that thou shalt come to be our judge. Now, Adrian recommended that we have a listen to the opening bars because they contain a very bold stroke, the four choirs entering one by one, creating dense chord clusters. It's a different harmonic feel from what we've had before. Some bits are reminiscent of Thales and others Verres. The opening of the fifth movement, Iudex crederis venturus. Almost a feeling of traditional Russian choral music there, only it builds up to become much more complex. Sopranos, altos, tenors and basses from all the choirs, all entering at different times and with quite varied phrases. Then after this big oasis of unaccompanied choral music, there's a sudden call to arms and we have trumpets calling from the distance. So the instruments are back and trumpets with their military connotations, leading to a very quiet horn solo that takes us into the next main section, and Ian is going to play this for us. Thank you, Ian. And that leads us to a new section marked pesante, very disturbing and warlike. And I notice that Brian uses the term nobili mente. I can't help but think of Elgar when I think of a noble quality in music. So the feeling of eclecticism is growing in this movement, choral writing using both ancient polyphonic traditions and modern clusters, military effects, romantic English music, and now offstage brass bands joining in with the chorus. And it all feels very unstable, very volatile. And if we were to continue the link with Goethe's Faust, we'd recall that Faust goes through some more turbulent adventures before his soul is rescued by angels. But bit by bit, the movement starts to turn itself around. And although the complexity remains, it gradually starts to feel as if the human soul is winning. The ending of the movement is loud and bright, and it fills us with confidence that whatever the music is battling against, it can win. So let's move on now to the final movement, and this is the longest movement we've encountered yet, and it starts with a solo on the oboe d'amore. The solo tenor singing the words, Te ergo quasumus, tuis famulis subveni, we beseech thee therefore to help thy servants. And this continues calmly until one particular line of the Te Deum sparks off a sort of celestial dance. It's the words, Aeterna fac cum sanctis tuis in gloria numerari, make them to be numbered with thy saints in everlasting glory. And there's wordless chorus in there, adding to that angelic feel. Well, this dance continues, and after the big build-up you heard at the start of this event, the next section of the music, for me, seems to confirm the message of the Gothic symphony. We've had hints of the military and hints of the celestial all the way through, and perhaps the most military-sounding bit of the whole symphony happens at this point. It's a jaunty marching song. It's played by 9 clarinets with percussion. Well, I think that's quite haunting. I know it's a favourite bit for two of my guests sitting here today. Havergal O'Brien said that for almost 10 years after the end of World War I, he continued to hear the tramp of an army in his mind. And the military flavour continues in a horn solo soon after this, which Ian's going to play for us now. Thank you, Ian. And that little tune reminds me a bit of English folk music. Well, after the military march has receded, the final stages of the Gothic Symphony are no longer optimistic. We're left to wonder whether the promise of angels rescuing our souls is really just a fairy story. Maybe the Te Deum isn't an expression of faith. Maybe it's just a reflection of a religious ideal, part of the fiction that is Goethe's Faust. In any case, we don't get a sense of triumphant redemption anymore. And Nick's going to play for us a violin melody from close to the end of the movement. Thank you, Nick. Well, that leads to the final outburst of the symphony, the music becoming more grotesque. But Brian leaves us with a soft, very sad coda, setting the words, non confundar in aeternum, O Lord, in thee I have hoped, let me never be put to shame. The closing bars of the Gothic Symphony. I think at this stage we can only ask ourselves if Havergal O'Brien had retained his hope in God, as the words of the prayer suggest. After the military nightmare that so much of the symphony seems to represent, he's asking a lot of himself to give thanks to the Lord. So whether those final bars could be a detached, even an ironic, quotation from an ancient prayer or a firm statement of continuing faith is very hard to say. And that question, that uncertainty, is perhaps the thing that's really bewildered listeners whenever they encounter this piece, which of course isn't very often. The story of Faust and the idea of a Te Deum hang together in perhaps a slightly awkward way, although you can understand how one might lead to the other. They're both underpinned by the Christian faith. But Havergal O'Brien had memories of the war in his very bones, and it's as if the war has leaked into the symphony and has interfered with both Goethe's story and the certainty of the prayer. Maybe there was a discrepancy between what Brian produced and what he intended to produce. Well, if so, I think that's very forgivable. Between the years of 1919 and 1927, when the piece was written, many composers were in a state of crisis. But of course, Havergal O'Brien had many more years in which to come to terms with the 20th century. He lived right up to 1972 and died at the age of 96. This mammoth piece, the first of 32 symphonies, was just the start. It may be his biggest statement, but it's not his last word. So I very much hope you enjoy it tonight. I'd like to thank you all for joining me here at the Royal College of Music, and also to thank my guests, Adrian Partington, Ian Fisher, and Nick Whiting. And I'll hand you on now to Broadcasting House.
And our thanks. Our thanks to Sarah Walker at the Royal College of Music. And just a reminder, as if you need it, that Havergal O'Brien's Gothic Symphony is live from the Royal Albert Hall in the Proms at 7 o'clock this evening. That's in almost exactly an hour's time from now.